Star Tide Rising, Cassette 4.
Chapter 20. Galactics. Battle screamed all around the flotilla of tiny Zappish warships.
"We have lost the Zaktau and the Zaklenu. That means a third of the Zappish armed might is gone."
The elder Zappish lieutenant sighed.
"So, young one, tell me news, not things I already know."
"Our Zatini patrons spend their clients like reaction gas and commit their own forces miserly. Notice how they hang back, ready to flee if the battle gets too furious. Yet we they send into danger."
"That is ever their way," the other agreed.
"But if the Zappish fleet is destroyed here in this futile fray, who will protect our three tiny worlds and enforce our rights?"
"Is that not what we have patrons for?"
The older lieutenant knew he was being ironic. He adjusted the screens to resist a sudden psionic attack, without even changing his tone of voice. His junior did not dignify the reply with a comment. He grumbled instead.
"What did these Earthlings ever do to us, anyway? In what way do they threaten our patrons?"
A searing blast from a Tandu battlecruiser just missed the left wing of the small Zappish scout. The junior lieutenant sent the ship into a wild, evasive maneuver. The senior lieutenant replied to the question as if nothing at all had happened.
"I take it you don't believe the story that the progenitors have returned."
The other only snorted while adjusting his torpedo sights.
"Aptly put, I, too, think this is merely part of a program to destroy the Earthlings. The senior patron races see the Terrans as a threat. They are wolflings, and therefore dangerous. They preach revolutionary uplift practices, more dangerous still. They are allies of the Timbrimi, an insult beyond forbearance, and they proselytize, an unforgivable offense."
The scout ship shuddered as the torpedo leapt toward the Tandu destroyer. Their tiny craft accelerated mightily to get away.
"Well, I think we should listen to the Earthlings," the junior lieutenant shouted. "If all the client races in the galaxy rebelled at once..."
"It has already happened," the elder interrupted.
"Study the library records. 6 times in galactic history, and twice successfully."
"No. What happened? What do you think happened? The clients went on to become patrons of newer species and treated them just the same as ever."
"I do not believe it. I cannot believe it."
The elder lieutenant sighed.
"Look it up."
"I shall."
But he never did. An undetected improbability mine lay across their path. The tiny scout departed the galaxy in a manner that was picturesque, if ultimately lethal. Chapter 21. Denny and Toshio. Denny checked the charges one more time. It was dark and crowded in the close passage of the drill tree root. Her helmet's beam cast stark shadows through the thick maze of rootlets. She called upward.
"Are you almost finished, Toshio?"
He was planting his explosives in the upper section, near the surface of the metal mound.
"Yeah, Denny, if you're done, go back down now. I'll join you in a minute."
She couldn't see his flippered feet above her. His voice was distorted in the narrow, water-filled thicket. It was a relief to be allowed to leave. She picked her way downward carefully, fighting back waves of claustrophobia. This was no job Denny would ever have chosen, but it had to be done, and the two dolphins were by nature unqualified. Halfway down, she snagged herself on a strand of creeper. It didn't let go when she tugged. Thrashing only entangled her further, and she vividly recalled Toshio's story of the killer weed. Panic almost closed in, but she forced herself to stop kicking, to take a deep breath, and study the snare. It was just a dead vine wrapped around one leg. The strand parted easily under her knife. She continued her descent more cautiously and escaped at last into the grotto beneath the metal mound. Kipiru and Saut waited below. Hose-like breathers covered their blowmouths and wrapped around their torsos. The headlights of the two sleds diffracted through thousands of tiny threads that seemed to fill the chamber in a drifting fog. A dim light filtered into the grotto from the cave mouth through which they had entered. Echoes sounding in this rock cage will not be those of happy fishing. Denny looked at Shout, unsure she had understood the poet's fancy trinary.
Oh, yes, when Toshio sets the fuses, we'd better get outside. The explosion will reverberate in this chamber.
Kipiru nodded in agreement. The expedition's military commander had been mostly silent all the way here from the ship. Denny looked around the underwater cavity. Coral-like, microscopic scavengers had built their castle on the rich silicate rocks of an ocean hillock. The structure had grown slowly, but when the mound finally breached the ocean surface, top life became possible. Among the vegetation which had sprouted was the drill tree. That plant somehow pierced the mound's metal core and penetrated to organically useful layers beneath the island. Minerals were drawn up and deposited above. A cavity grew below, which would eventually accept the metal mound into the crust again. Something struck the ecologist in Denny as odd about this arrangement. The tiny micro-branch library aboard Streaker hadn't mentioned the metal mounds at all, which was also curious. It was hard to believe the drill tree could evolve into its niche in a gradual way, as most species did. For the tree to succeed was an all-or-nothing proposition, requiring great power and perseverance. How did it get that way? Denny wondered. And what happened to the mounds after they fell into the cavities the drill trees prepared for them? She had seen some pits which had swallowed their mounds. Their depths were cloudy and obscure, and apparently far deeper than she would have expected. She shone her beam on the bottom of the mound. The reflections were really quite startling. Denny had expected something ragged and irregular, not a field of bright concave pits on the shining metal underside. She swam to one of the larger depressions, bringing up her camera. Charlie Dart would like pictures and samples from this trip. She knew better than to expect thanks. More likely each tantalizing photo or rock would send him into exasperated sighs over her failure to follow up obvious leads. Deep within one of the pits, something moved, a twisting and slow turning. Denny reoriented her beam and peered closer. It was a root of some sort. She watched several of the tiny drifting threads fly within reach of the hanging tendril to be caught and drawn within. She grabbed at a few for her sample bag.
"Let's go, Denny," she heard Toshio call. There was a thrumming sound as a sled moved just beneath her.
"Come on, we've only got 5 minutes till they blow."
"Okay, okay," she said. "Give me a minute."
Professional curiosity momentarily overwhelmed other thoughts. Denny could think of no reason why a living thing should burrow into the lightless underside of a mass of almost pure metal. She reached far into the pit and grabbed the twisting tendril root, then braced herself against the bulk of the mound and pulled hard. At first, the springy root was adamant and seemed even to pull back. The possibility that she had trapped herself vividly occurred to Denny. The root tore free suddenly. Denny glimpsed a shiny hard tip as she stuffed the specimen into a sample bag. She flipped and kicked away from the metal surface. Kipiru looked at her reproachfully as she grabbed the sled. He gunned the machine toward the cave entrance and out into the daylight where Toshio and Seout waited. Moments later, a loud concussion sent booming echoes through the shallows. They waited an hour, then re-entered the grotto. The charges had shattered the drill tree trunk where it pierced the bottom side of the metal mound. The severed shaft canted at an angle below, continuing down into murky depths. Bits of debris still fell from the opening in the mound's bottom. The chamber below the island was thick with swirling shreds of vegetation. They approached the opening cautiously.
"I'd better check it out with a robot first," Toshio said. "There may be unstable chunks left in the shaft."
"I will do this, ladder runner. Robots, heed my close nerve socket."
Toshio nodded.
"Yeah, you're right. You do it, Kipiru."
The pilot, with his direct machine-nerve interface, would be able to control the probe better than Toshio. Of the human support, only Emerson Dianati and Thomas Orley had such cyborg links. It would be a long time before most humans could deal with the side effects of socket implantation, as well as dolphins, who needed the interface far more and had been bred for it. Under Kipiro's direction, a small probe detached itself from the rear of the sled, jetted off toward the hole, and disappeared within. Toshio had never expected to be sent right back out again with Kipiru to a site where, in his opinion, neither of them had behaved particularly well. The importance of their mission, to serve and protect two important scientists, confused him even further. Why didn't Krydike assign someone else, someone more reliable? Of course, the captain might have ordered all four of them out of the ship to get them out of his way, but that didn't seem to fit either. Toshio decided not to try to pierce Krydike's logic. Inscrutability seemed to be at the heart of it. Perhaps that was what it was to be a captain. Toshio only knew that he and Kipiru were both determined to do a good job on this mission. As a midshipman, he officially outranked Kipiru, but tradition made warrant officers and pilots masters of middies, unless otherwise decided by higher authority. Toshio would be assisting Denny and Saut in their studies. On security matters, Kipiru was in charge. Toshio was still surprised to find that others stopped and listened when he made suggestions. His opinions had been routinely solicited. That alone would take some getting used to. The screen showed a picture sent back by the robot, a hollow cylindrical excavation through the foamy metal. Broken stumps were all that remained of the anchor bearings that had held the drill tree shaft in place. Bits of debris drifted down past the camera as they watched. As the robot rose, the light from above slowly grew brighter through a thin haze of bubbles.
"Think it's wide enough to pass a sled?" Toshio asked.
Kipiru whistled that the passage looked navigable. The robot surfaced into a pool several meters wide. Its camera panned the rim, transmitting images of blue sky and thick green foliage. The high trunk of the drill tree had crashed into the forest. The slope of the pool made it hard to see the damage this had done, but Toshio was sure it hadn't fallen in the direction of the Abo village. They had worried that blasting away to the interior of the island might panic the hunter-gatherers. They took the risk anyway, because routinely trying to scale the treacherous island walls in open surf would have been dangerous and a foolish exposure to galactic spy satellites. The apparently random falling of a tree on an island would hardly be noted by anyone watching from above.
"Uh-oh,"
Toshio pointed. Denny moved closer to look at the screen.
"What is it, Tosh? Is there a problem?"
Kipiru stopped the camera as it was about to finish its scan.
"There," Toshio said. "That jagged crop of coral is hanging over the pool. It looks about to fall."
"Well, can you have the robot wedge something under to prevent it?"
"I don't know. What do you think, Kipiru?"
"Some scheme may work if fate buys it. We'll make a gamble and simply try it."
Kipiru eyed his twin screens and concentrated. Toshio knew the pilot was listening,
to a complex pattern of sound images transmitted over his neural link. Under Kipiru's command, the robot moved to the edge of the pool. Its claw arms grabbed the spongy metal of the rim to pull forward. There was a small rain of pebbles as it brought its treads to bear. "Watch out!" Toshio called. The jagged rock tipped forward. The camera showed it tottering ominously. Denny cringed back from the screen. Then the rock toppled over and crashed into the robot. There followed a swirl of spinning images. Denny continued watching the screen, but Toshio and Kipiru shifted their gaze to the bottom of the shaft. Suddenly, a rain of objects fell from the gap, tumbling into the darkness below. The debris sparkled in the sled's beams as it dropped into the abyss. After a long silence, Kipiru spoke. "The probe is down there, lungs unbreathing. I was spared the cutoff false death. It still whistles, stranded echoes." Kipiru meant that the probe still sent him messages from whatever murky ledge had finally stopped it. Its tiny brain and transmitter hadn't been destroyed, and Kipiru had not suffered the jolt that a sudden cutoff could send to a connected nervous system. But the robot's flotation tanks had been ruined. It was down there for good. "That must be the last obstruction. I shall go then, carefully, testing. Denny, take the sled and watch me." Before Kipiru or Toshio could stop him, Saut was off his sled and away. He fluked mightily and disappeared into the shaft. Kipiru and Toshio looked at each other, sharing a malign thought about crazy civilians. At least Toshio thought he could have taken a camera with him. But then, if Saut had waited, Toshio would have had a chance to insist on the dubious privilege of scouting the passage. He looked at Denny. She watched the robot probe screen, as if it might deliver some token about what was happening to Saut. She had to be reminded to swim over and take control of the other sled. Toshio had always thought of Denny Sudman as one more adult scientist, friendly but enigmatic. Now he saw that she was not an awful lot more mature than he, and while she had the honor and status of a full professional, she lacked the eclecticism his officer training was giving him. She would never encounter the range of people, things, and situations he would in the course of his career. He looked again to the shaft entrance. Kipiru blew nervous bubbles. They would have to decide soon what to do if Saut did not reappear. Saut was obviously a genetic experiment in which the gene crafters were pushing a set of traits toward a calculated optimum. If judged successful, the traits would be grafted into the main pool of the neo-dolphin species. The process imitated, on a vastly quicker scale, the segregation and mixing that worked in nature. Such experiments sometimes resulted in things not planned, though. Toshio wasn't sure he trusted Saut. The Finn's obscurity wasn't like the inscrutability of Crydike, deep and thoughtful. It grated like the dissembling of some humans he had known. Also, there was the sexual game between Saut and Denny. Not that he was a prude. Such hobbies weren't exactly forbidden, but they had been known to cause problems. Apparently, Denny wasn't even aware of the subtle ways she was encouraging Saut. Toshio wondered if he had the nerve to tell her, or if it was any of his business. Another tense minute passed. Then, just as Toshio was about to go himself, Saut shot out of the shaft and swooped toward them. "The way is clear. I'll lead you airward." Kipiru jetted his sled over to the dolphin anthropologist and squawked something pitched so high that Toshio couldn't quite catch it, even with his Calafian sensitivity. Saut's mouth twisted and closed into a reluctant attitude of submission. Still, there was something defiant in his eye. He cast a look at Denny, even as he rolled over to offer one of his ventral fins to Kipiru's mouth. The pilot took a token nip, then turned back to the others. "The way is clear. I do believe him. Now let us go and drop these breathers to talk like Earthmen about our work, and to meet our future pilot brothers." The sled moved under the drill tree shaft, then rose in a cloud of bubbles. The others followed. Chapter 22. Crydike. The briefing had gone on far too long. Crydike regretted ever letting Charles Dart attend via holoscreen. The chimp planetologist would have been less long-winded if he were here in the fizzing oxy-water of the Central Bay, wet and wearing a face mask. Dart lounged in his own laboratory, projecting his image, oblivious to the chafing of his listeners. Breathing oxy-water in front of a console for 2 hours was highly uncomfortable to a neo-fin.
"Naturally, Captain."
The chimp's scratchy baritone throbbed into the water.
"When you chose to land us near a major tectonic boundary, I approved wholeheartedly. Nowhere else offered so much data in one spot. Still, I think I've made a convincing case for 6 or 7 more sampling sites distributed about Kithrop to verify some of the extremely interesting discoveries we've made here."
Crydike was mildly surprised. Using the first personal plural was the first modest thing Charlie had said. Brukita floated nearby. The metallurgist had been working with Charles Dart, his skills not currently required by the repair team. He had been largely silent for the last hour, letting the chimp pour out tides of tactical jargon. "What's the matter with Brukita? Does he think a captain under siege has nothing better to do?" Hikahi, recently released from sick bay, rolled over on her back, breathing the fizzing oxygenated fluid and keeping one eye to the hologram of the chimpanzee. "She shouldn't do that," Crydike thought. "I'm having enough trouble concentrating as it is." A lengthy, constricting meeting always did this to Crydike. He felt a stirring of blood in and around his penile sheath. What he wanted to do was swim over to Hikahi and bite her softly in numerous places up and down her flanks. Kinky, yes, especially in public, but at least he was honest with himself. "Planetologist Dart," he sighed, "I am trying very hard to understand what you claim to have discovered. The part about various crystalline and isotopic anomalies below the crust of Kithrop, I think I follow. As for the subduction layer..."
"A subduction zone is a boundary of two crustal plates, where one slips below its neighbor,"
Charlie interrupted. Crydike wished he could let down his dignity to curse. "I know that much planetology, Dr. Dart." He spoke carefully. "And I'm glad our being near one of these plate boundaries is useful to you. But our choice of landing site was based on matters tactical. We want the metals and camouflage offered by the coral mounds. With hostile cruisers overhead, I can't think of permitting expeditions to other parts of the globe. In fact, I must refuse your request for further drilling at this location. The risk is too great." The chimp frowned. His hands began to flutter. Before he found the words, Crydike cut him off. "Besides, what does the ship's microbranch say about Kithrop? Doesn't the library contribute anything on these problems you face?"
"The library,"
Dart snorted.
"That pack of lies, that friggin' morass of misinformation."
Charlie's voice dropped to a growl.
"It has nothing on the anomalies. It doesn't even mention the metal mounds. The last survey was done over 400 million years ago, when the planet was put on reserve status for the Kerank."
Charlie became so strangled around the extended glottal stop that he started to choke.
He went bug-eyed and pounded himself on the chest, coughing. Kreideike turned to Brukida. "Is this true? Is the library so deficient on this planet?"
"Yes," Brukida nodded slowly. 400 epochs is a long time. When a world is placed on reserve, it's usually either to let it lie fallow, while new species evolve to a level ripe for uplift, or to provide a quiet place of decline for an ancient race entering senescence. Planets are placed off-limits either to become nurseries or old-age homes.
Both seem to have occurred on Kithrop. We have discovered a ripe, pre-sentient race, which has apparently risen since the last library update. Also, the Karank, Brukida, too, had trouble with the name, were granted the planet as a peaceful place to die, which they apparently have done. There seem to be no Karank anymore.
But 400 epochs without a resurvey?
It was difficult to imagine.
Yes, a planet is usually relicensed by the Institute of Migration long before that. Still, Kithrop is such a strange world. Few species would choose to live here. Also, good access routes are scarce. This region of space is gravitationally very shallow. It's one reason we came here.
Charles Dart was still catching his breath. He drank from a tall glass of water. During the respite, Kreideike lay still, thinking. Despite Brukida's points, would Kithrop really have been left fallow for so long in an overcrowded galaxy where every piece of real estate was desired? The Institute of Migration was the only one of the loose galactic bureaucracies whose power and influence rivaled even that of the Library Institute. By tradition, all patron lines obeyed its codes of ecosphere management. To do otherwise courted galaxy-wide disaster. The potential of lesser species to one day become clients, then patrons in their own time, made for a powerful galaxy-wide ecological conservatism. Most galactics were willing to overlook humanity's pre-contact record. The slaughter of the mammoth, the giant ground sloth, and the manatee were forgiven in light of mankind's orphan status. The real blame was laid on Homo sapiens' supposed patron, the mysterious, undiscovered race that all said must have left humanity's uplift half-finished thousands of years ago. Dolphins knew how close the cetaceans themselves had come to extinction at the hands of human beings, but they never mentioned it outside Earth. For well or ill, their fate was now linked to mankind's. Earth was humanity's until the race moved on or died out. Her 10 colony worlds were licensed for smaller periods, based on complex eco-management plans. The shortest lease was a mere 6,000 years. Then the colonists of At Last had to depart, leaving the planet fallow once again.
400 million years, Kreideike mulled. That seems an unusually long time with no resurvey.
I agree,
Charlie Dart shouted, now fully recovered.
And what if I told you Kithrop was occupied by a machine civilization as recently as 30,000 years ago, without any entry in the library at all?
Ikahi rolled over closer.
You think these crustal anomalies betray an interloper civilization, Dr. Dart?
Yes,
he cried.
Exactly. You all know many eco-sensitive races will only build major facilities along a planet's plate boundaries. That way, when the planet is later declared fallow, all traces of habitation will be sucked down into the mantle and disappear. And some think that's why there are no signs of previous occupancy on Earth.
Ikahi nodded.
And if some species settled here illegally?
They'd build only at a plate boundary. The library surveys planets at multi-epoch intervals. All evidence of the incursion would be sucked underground by then.
The chimp looked eagerly from the holo display. Krydike had trouble taking this very seriously. Charlie made it sound like a whodunit. Only in this case, the culprits were civilizations, the clues whole cities, and the rug under which the evidence was being swept was a planet's crust. It was the perfect crime. After all, the cop on the corner only swings by every few million years, and is late at that. Krydike realized every metaphor he had just used was a human one. Well, that was to be expected. There were times, such as space warp piloting, when cetacean analogies were more useful. But when thinking about the crazy politics of the galactics, it helped to have watched a lot of old human movie thrillers and read volumes of crazy human history. Now, Brukida and Dart were arguing some technical point, and all Krydike could think of was the taste of the water near Hikahi. He badly wanted to ask her if the flavor meant what he thought it meant. Was it a perfume she had put on, or natural pheromone? With some difficulty, he forced himself back to the subject at hand. Charlie's and Brukida's discovery under normal circumstances would be exciting. But this has no bearing on escape for my ship and crew, nor getting our data back to the Terrigan's Council. Even the mission I sent Kipiru and Toshio on, to help appraise the native pre-sentience, is more urgent than hunting arcane clues in ancient alien rocks.
Excuse me, Captain, I'm sorry I'm late. I've been listening quietly for a while, though.
Krydike turned to see Dr. Ignacio Metz drift up alongside. The gangling, gray-haired psychologist treaded water slowly, casually compensating for a small negative buoyancy. A slight potbelly distended the neat fit of his slick brown dry suit. Brukida and Dart argued on, now about rates of heating by radioactives, gravity, and meteoritic impact. Hikahi apparently found it all fascinating.
You're welcome even late, Dr. Metz. I'm glad you could make it.
Krydike was amazed he hadn't heard the man approach. Metz normally made a racket you could hear halfway across the bay. He sometimes radiated a 2 kilohertz hum from his right ear. It was barely detectable now, but at times it was quite annoying. How could a man have worked with fins for so long and never had the problem corrected? Now I'm beginning to sound like Charlie Dart, he chided himself. Don't be peevish, Krydike. He whistled a stanza, which echoed only within his own skull. Those who live all vibrate, all, and aid the world's singing. Captain, I actually came out here for another reason, but Dart's and Brukida's discovery may bear on what I have to say. Can we talk in private? Krydike became expressionless. He had to get some rest and exercise soon. Overwork was wearing him down, and Streaker could ill afford that. But this human had to be treated carefully. Metz could not command him, aboard Streaker or anywhere, but he had power, power of a particularly potent kind. Krydike knew that his own right of reproduction was guaranteed, no matter how this mission ended. Still, Metz's evaluation would carry weight. Every dolphin aboard behaved as sentiently as possible around him, even the captain. Perhaps that's why I've put off a confrontation, Krydike thought. Soon, though, he would force Dr. Metz to answer some questions regarding certain members of Streaker's crew.
Very well, Doctor, he answered. Allow me a moment.
Hikahi swam close at a nod from Krydike. She grinned and flicked her pectorals at Metz.
Hikahi, please finish up here for me. Don't let them go more than another 10 minutes before summing up. Meet me in an hour in Recreation Pool 3A with your recommendations. She answered as he had addressed her, in rapid, highly inflected underwater Anglic.
Aye, aye, Captain. Will there be anything else?
Damn. Crydike knew Hikahi's sonar showed her everything about his sexual agitation. It was easy to tell with a male. He would have to do an explicit sonic scan of her innards to gain some information about her, and that would not be polite. Things must have been so much simpler in the old times. Well, he would find out her frame of mind in an hour. One of the privileges of captaincy was to order a recreation pool cleared. There had better not be an emergency between now and then. No, nothing else for now, Hikahi. Carry on. She saluted snappily with an arm of her harness. Rukita and Charlie were still arguing as Crydike turned back to Metz. Will it be private enough if we take the long way to the bridge, Doctor? I'd like to check with Takata Jim before going on to other duties.
That'll be fine, Captain. What I have to say won't take long.
Crydike kept his face impassive. Was Metz smiling at something in particular? Something he had seen or heard?
I am still confused by the pattern of volcanoes up and down the 3,000-kilometer zone where these two plates meet, Brukita said.
He spoke slowly, partly for Charlie's benefit, and partly because it was hard to argue in oxywater. There never seemed to be enough air.
If you look at the survey charts we made from orbit, you see that volcanism is dispersed sparsely elsewhere on the planet. But here, the volcanoes are very frequent and all about the same small size.
Charlie shrugged.
I don't see how that relates at all, old man.
But isn't this also the only area where metal mounds are found?
Hikahi suggested.
I'm no expert, but a spacer learns to be suspicious of twin coincidences.
Charlie opened and closed his mouth as if he were about to speak, then thought better of it. At last he said,
Brukita, you think these coral critters may need some nutrient that only this type of volcano provides?
Possibly. Our exobiology expert is Denny Sudman. She's now at one of the islands investigating the aboriginals.
She must get samples for us.
Charlie rubbed his hands together.
Do you think it'd be too much to ask her to take a side trip to a volcano? Not too far away, of course, after what Crydike just said. Just a little teeny one.
Hikahi let out a short whistling laugh. The fellow had chutzpah. Still, his enthusiasm was infectious, a wonderful distraction from worry. If only she could afford to hide away from the dangerous universe in abstractions, like Charlie Dart did.
And a temperature probe,
Charlie cried.
Surely Denny'd do that much for me, after all I've done for her.
Crydike cruised a wide spiral around the swimming human, stretching his muscles as he arched and twisted. By neural command, he flexed his harness's major manipulators, like a human exercising his arms.
Very well, Doctor. What can I do for you?
Metz swam a slow kickstroke. He regarded Crydike amiably.
Captain, I believe it's time to rethink our strategy. Matters have changed since we came to Kithra.
Could you be specific?
Certainly. As you recall, we fled from the transfer point at Morgren because we didn't wish to be crushed in a 7-way ambush. You were quick to realize that even if we surrendered to one party, this would only result in all sides ganging up on our captors, inevitably leading to our destruction.
I was slow to understand your logic. Now I applaud it. Of course, your tactical maneuvers were brilliant.
Thank you, Dr. Metz. You leave out another reason for our flight. We are under orders from the Terrigan's Council to bring our data directly to them, without leaks. Our capture would classify as a leak, wouldn't you say?
Certainly,
Metz agreed. And so the situation remained when we fled to Kithrop, a move which I now consider inspired. To my way of thinking, it was just bad luck this hiding place didn't work as planned. Krydike refrained from pointing out that they were still concealed in this hiding place.
Go on, he suggested.
Well, the chance of escape is now next to nil. Kithrop remains a refuge from the chaos of battle, but it can't hide us for long once there is a final victor overhead.
You're suggesting?
I think we should consider our priorities and plan for unpleasant contingencies.
What priorities do you consider important? Krydike knew the answer to expect.
Why, the survival of this ship and crew, of course, and the data for evaluating the performance of both. After all, what was our main purpose out here,
Metz stopped swimming, regarding Krydike like a teacher quizzing a pupil. Krydike could list a half-dozen tasks that had been set for Streaker, from library veracity checks to establishing contact with potential allies to Thomas Orley's military intelligence work. As Metz alluded, the primary purpose was to evaluate a Dolphin-crewed, Dolphin-commanded spacecraft. Streaker and her complement were the experiment. But everything had changed since they found the derelict fleet. He couldn't operate under the priorities he had been given at the beginning. How could he explain that to a man like Metz?
Judgment, Krydike mused. Thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Sometimes he thought that the bard must have been half-dolphin himself.
I understand your point, Dr. Metz, but I don't see how it calls for a change in strategy. We still face destruction should we poke our beaks above Kithrop's sea.
Only if we do so before there's a winner overhead. Certainly we shouldn't expose ourselves until the crossfire is over.
However, we are in a position to negotiate once there is a victor. We may yet win success for this mission.
Krydike resumed his slow spiral, forcing the geneticist to swim again toward the bridge lock.
Can you suggest what we might have to offer in negotiation, Dr. Metz?
Metz smiled.
For one thing, we have the information Bruchita and Charles Dart have literally dug up. The institutes reward those who report ecological crimes. Most of the factions fighting over us are traditionalist conservatives of one stripe or another, and would appreciate our discovery.
Krydike refrained from expressing in raspberries his contempt for the man's naivete.
Go on, Doctor, he said levelly. What else have we to offer?
Well, Captain, there's also the honor of our mission. Even if our captors decided to hold on to Streaker for a while, they'd certainly be sympathetic to our purpose. Teaching clients to use spaceships is one of the basic tasks of uplift. Surely they'd let us send a few men and Fenn home with our behavior evaluation data, so progress toward future Dolphin-crewed ships can continue. For them to do otherwise would be like a stranger interfering in the development of a child because of an argument with its parent.
And how many human children were tortured and killed because of the sins of their parents back in your own dark ages? Krydike wanted to ask who would be the emissary to carry the uplift data back to Earth while Streaker was held captive.
Dr. Metz, I think you underestimate the fanaticism of those involved.
But is there more?
Of course, I saved the most important for last.
Metz touched Krydike's flank for emphasis.
We must consider giving the Galactics what they want.
Krydike had expected it. You think we should give up the location of the derelict fleet?
Yes, and whatever souvenirs or data we picked up there.
Krydike wore his poker face. How much does he know about Jillian's Herbie, he wondered. Great dreamer, but that cadaver's caused problems.
This ends side one of cassette 4.